Good morning. It is Friday and we are ready to take on the weekend. I hope you are too. It's also payday for most people, so that's good news.
Oh, yeah.
You know, August, that 31st day, which is tomorrow, kind of feels unnecessary. You know, these months that have 31 days, it's like a little bit greedy. They should all do 30 and we should just be happy with that. Anyway, September the 1st, Sunday, spring day. That's officially where it all changes. And I think we've got this last little cold snap now. Cape Town certainly had it. By the way, and I'm going to talk about this because the person who said to me they thought it was bullshit was Alan Ford. I spoke to him on the phone. He was furious. Like, I've never heard him so angry and ranty. He was like, "Duh, this Cape Town snow on Table Mountain thing is bullshit," he said. It's bullshit. He said, "There's no such thing." He said it was totally made up. He reckons it's a complete fallacious thing. He had a friend in Cape Town. He said to him, "Look out of the window. Tell me, is there snow on the mountain?" Friend said, "Well, I can't really tell. There's a cloud." He's like, "It's impossible. It was 8 degrees. You can't get snow at 8 degrees. He's got a point. So if you were passing around those videos of the snow on Table Mountain, it's probably bullshit.
So I can tell you, a friend of mine in Cape Town, he went hunting for snow yesterday.
Yeah.
And he got full snow.
Really?
Drove out there with some friends, making snowmen, throwing snowballs at each other.
So Alan, that's advice.
Alan, maybe not so fuckable anymore. I'm getting angry. I'm getting angry, Alan. It was cold.
Speaking of angry, you know, people who don't study history have an idea of what Nazis were, but the Nazis were very bizarre. Like, in general. And then, of course, the leaders, the main characters, were even more bizarre.
Okay.
You got basically Hitler, Himmler, Goebbels, Goering, Röhm, Heydrich. I mean, it sounds, you know, they sound like they were pretty much like really. By the way, before we even get into that, a friend of mine is in Germany right now. And this is not to beat up on Germans. I love Germany. I've been there myself. It's a great country. But Germans are weird. Okay. Just take a look at this. A friend of mine recorded this from the TV in his hotel room as he got into Berlin last night. Just take a look. This is what they watch on TV in Germany. What is that? Yeah, exactly.
As I said often, people shouldn't rip off Afrikaans people.
That is their version. Okay, you can stop. That is the German version of MTV, by the looks of things. So they have a guy cutting meat, and then they've got oompa music with an accordion.
And a bit of a bucky as well. Guys, what if Afrikaans people are actually becoming so trendy? I mean, we saw it with that Dutch music video you showed me
that's
the other
true,
day.
Yeah.
I think it all started with Kurt Darren, and it's like been this wave.
Well,
that maybe other countries are looking at this.
I don't know that that's exactly the kind of wave we want to be responsible for. But back to German history. So obviously the Nazis, not a very proud moment in German history, but a big problem for the world. Ben wanted to talk about them this morning, and they're always worthy of discussion because God alone knows we don't want to go back to anything like that. Mm-hmm. But it turns out as you watch more and more of these documentaries that are coming out, most of these guys were high the whole time.
The whole time.
The Nazis were always fucking high. They were tweaking every moment of the day.
Yeah.
You could see Hitler. There's this one clip of him at the Olympics in Berlin, and he's like, and you think, well, he's just Hitler, you know, so he's anxious.
I'm glad you bring up Berlin because that's where it started. In 1935, they had the Berlin Olympics, and that was going to be the big thing for the Third Reich. This is our chance to show how amazing our athletes are, how we're superior as a race. And then the unfortunate thing that Jesse Owens, the black man from America, rocked up and he won all the races.
And they hated that.
And they hated
Nazis.
That. And they were like,
those Nazis were so
they
fucking
were so
rough.
Angry.
Can you imagine?
It was the worst thing. I mean, it was worse than the All Blacks
that's
coming here
calm,
and potentially winning. And what they concluded was not that the fact that basically everyone knows black people have more fast twitch muscles than white people. So historically, they're better sprinters. If you just look at genetics, he was like, no, Americans are on better drugs. We need to make better drugs because there's no ways a black guy can beat a white guy. This was
Hitler.
This was their thing. So that's when the meth started to be manufactured.
Right.
So they, you say what you want about the Nazis, you say what you want about any bad people, they had good scientists, they had very smart people, they had good engineers.
So that was their form of doping.
Also, if they didn't deliver the goods, Hitler just throw them in a camp.
Yeah.
And that would be the last you'd hear of them. So they had to really work day and night to try and crack whatever he wanted cracked, if it, even if it was crack.
But that was the thing about the Nazis in general. I mean, you look at these soft socialists nowadays or these stupid communists, they're just in it for the money and just to get things. Hitler wanted excellence.
Oh, he wanted to win so bad.
And it was this obsession which made him very weird.
Right.
So this hasn't really come out in like in a huge, like, wouldn't see it in textbooks growing up about this whole meth thing. But a guy called Norman Oller, who's a German author, I credit all of this to him. There was a podcast with him on Joe Rogan. And the Germans being the Germans, they're fantastic archivers. Mm-hmm. So this oak realized this and went in back into the archives and he just read everything possible.
Wow.
And a lot of these big German pharmaceutical companies, because as we know, during the Nazi times, big companies made lots of money.
Yeah.
So people don't want to say it, but like a company like Mercedes, for example.
Yes.
They were there in the mix.
VW.
You got bosses making nice suits for them. So pharmaceutical companies were exactly the same for Hitler's meth needs. So they started producing this sort of methamphetamine around the mid-30s. And then as things escalated towards the war times, Hitler had this plan. Now, the French, now this was a surprise to me, but back then, late 30s, the French actually had a really big army, a really good army, and they were dominant, and they were seen as a real force. The Germans did not have the manpower. They didn't have anything to compete with them, but they had meth. And they had Hitler realizing that meth's actually quite an inspiring thing for young men. Yeah. Another great thing about meth is that it's not a great drug for intelligence, but it is for application. So if you want to solve a puzzle or you want to play, you want to need to, I don't know, do something, Adderall's great. Makes it a bit more tuned.
Sure.
But meth makes you a great blunt object where you get through work without thinking too much and you have zero self-consciousness.
So for soldiers, perfect.
Exactly. And you've got zero self-awareness on it, basically. So you don't think about your actions. You just do them.
Mm-hmm.
So meth's a really, really great thing if you just want blunt objects. Hitler realized this. So what the Nazis were able to do in the first few days of the war was incredible because they didn't sleep. They went on like a four-day rage because they were so high on meth. And they had zero accountability. They had zero problems. Hitler designed the best war machine on meth. And it took the French by surprise because the French game plan was, when you're at war, you're entitled to, I don't know, three bottles of wine. And they would go to all the nice chateaus and they would just pull the wine out because the French saw it like a cricket match.
Well, the French do everything in a very civilized way. I mean, they take three lunch breaks. They have petit déjeuner. Then they have, un dîner in the evening, un après dîner, un post dîner. They have all these different things and they always drink wine and, you know, they'll eat with cutlery.
And that was the game plan.
Yeah. I mean, the French trenches in World War One, it was very important that they had decent food and
so can you imagine you're a French guy in a town, you got a bit of Bordeaux on the breath, and then Heinz, his jaw is off his charts, comes steamrolling through your village and fucking breaks your shit. And that's what the Nazis did. And it was just crazy how Hitler kept thinking about this kind of stuff. And he had all these great physicians and all these doctors.
And he himself was on it.
He was on all of the stuff.
He had to make sure they're on the good stuff.
Yes. I mean, he was. So there are all these documentaries now on the History Channel. It's pretty much all Nazis and meth. If you tune in at the wrong time, that's all you get on the menu, right? And it turns out that all these guys were doing cocaine, methamphetamines, all kinds of what we would call like concentrate drugs now, nootropics, effectively. I mean, that's what they were on. And it works for a little while, but your burnout's pretty severe after that.
It's hugely severe, but they would just keep tapping up to that. So the guys were getting worn out, but that the whole thing was that it was the Nazi war machine, and methed up soldiers were huge cogs of that. So there's a couple of things that spreads out. Okay, stick with Hitler. Hitler went through highs and lows, obviously, because he was obviously burning out. Mm-hmm. And he had a particular doctor who he was experimenting things with. And he would do all of Hitler's bloods and all this kind of stuff. And there was a particular time when Mussolini wanted out. Mm. He was like, this isn't going so well. My fascism isn't quite working.
Yeah.
It's just not looking that good. So he basically went to Hitler to resign from the war, to put it in simple terms.
Yeah.
And Hitler was so low that day. So he said to his doctor, I need something. I need just to get a bit of a second wind going here. And strangely enough, you know, Oxycontin's a real big problem, opioid crisis.
Especially in America, yeah.
His doctor essentially invented Oxycontin on the day that Mussolini came around for tea, gave it to Hitler. Hitler did not stop talking for like 6 hours.
Can you imagine?
He scared the living shit out of Mussolini.
I know no one's ever said these words, but I kind of feel sorry for Mussolini. Because can you imagine sitting there and you don't know, like you think, these are all humans I'm dealing with. But this guy, for the first time ever, like this is the first proper occasion that Mussolini's probably ever encountered this stuff in his life. He didn't know even. So he thinks this is the most insane human being I've ever met. And Mussolini's like, how the fuck do I get out of this? And Hitler's just, just ranting. And I mean, it must have been terrifying.
By all counts, it was. The man was terrified. He realized he couldn't go anywhere. He was stuck in this war now.
God.
And basically, Oxycontin was now coursing through Hitler's veins. And of course, going back to the thing that meth makes you a bit of a blunt object, like we all know that the big German war machine overextended itself towards Russia, the Soviet Union out that way. They're all on meth, and they just sort of ran out of resources.
Operation Barbarossa.
Imagine the come down. If you don't supply enough meth, what the soldier's going to be like? Jeez, that's pretty rough.
I heard a fascinating story. I don't know if it has to do with meth, but when Ernst Röhm was in charge of the Sturmabteilung, the SA, the actual original army, so this is before Hitler had become Kanzler, he was in a spa town and there was a big SA meeting and they'd all got together and Hitler decided he needed to go and remove this guy because he was a threat to his authority, effectively. And they went into this tiny little German spa town. You know, spa towns are a big deal in Germany. We'll go for the button, you know, and Baden-Baden this and Baden that and whatever. Anyway, he apparently burst into Ernst Röhm's room, Hitler, while the guy, he'd just gone to sleep or something. I mean, I can think of nothing more terrifying than this. You know, monsters and inbred people or whatever, but there's nothing more terrifying than you're just dozing off. And Adolf Hitler bursts into your room. He had a whip and he started ranting and raving and screaming at Röhm and cracking his whip. I mean, I think that's got to be in all of human history, like one of the most scary things.
It's weird. Marvel have made so many movies. Middle-aged meth man has not been a villain yet.
No.
But it was the greatest villain of all time.
Good Lord.
So it's quite another thing about the Nazis and the German system, that the Health Führer, there was actually a guy, obviously the Minister of Health, he was against the meth because he had the whole misconception that the Aryan race would be superior anyway.
Yeah.
They wouldn't need the drugs.
Yeah.
Obviously, he was worked out of the system a little bit.
Yeah. They were like, well, we like that, but we like this more.
But essentially, it was the methamphetamine. I don't know. There's different kinds of meth. But then the English got wind of this and they realized, like, these guys are killing everyone because they're on drugs, on hard drugs. So they did their own sort of research and being more gentlemanly, they had a bit of a softer meth that came into the ranks.
So they also did some. So
they did a few enhancers.
About, you know? Wow.
So drugs as we know them, essentially the Second World War started how these things work.
So are you saying, in summary, that if we want to perform really well, we should all be doing meth?
Well, that's where I want to take the conversations. Where can we put meth into society? What do we need
is
to get
done? Is this our advice to the audience this
what
morning?
What do we need to get done? It doesn't take a lot of intelligence, but we just need a bit of application.
I don't know.
Look, I'm not saying Miners for Meth is a new campaign.
The only thing I know for sure is that when I've gone to festivals and things and I've watched people going
on meth, yeah,
I don't think that they're particularly dangerous.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. They are trying to conquer a dance floor rather than a country. So the motive is
fair.
But you
think if you could give them a goal that was a little more ambitious,
set them to task,
they could actually do some damage.
So to go with Sam Neill and make this a full circle moment, pull yourself together, get some meth, and pretty much anything is possible.
Don't do that.
And that's why you can't take meth at the Olympics, people.
Don't do that, please.
But it's crazy. This guy, Norman Oller, he's very interesting. He dedicated so much of his life to go through this. And some pharmaceutical companies absolutely just brick-walled him when he wanted to get into this. So Hitler's guys, look at Hitler on this picture here.
Look at him. He's so high.
So this guy went into some of the archives, and then people started to understand what he was looking for. And these big pharmaceutical companies, they said, no, you won't have this information. Because Hitler's guys would go and say, right, pharmaceutical company, give me all your meth. And they're like, well, we've only got a kilogram. It's like, can you give me 10 by September? And that's how it happened. And these companies, because again, wartime is a good time for some companies. You get very, very rich. And a lot of these people who now make things for headaches, whatever, they were making the meth for Hitler.
Wow. They've got a pretty dodgy past. Huh?
And the whole opioid crisis that we see around the world, it started with Hitler.
Who knew? Thank you for that, Ben. I love a little history, especially when we can get into it on a Friday morning. That's very, very cool. Just by the way, speaking of history, last week was a big week in American politics. They had the Democratic National Convention. Everybody's talking about Barack Obama. Oprah spoke. Kamala Harris obviously spoke. The VP, Tim Walz, spoke. Mm. But I don't know that anybody really paid terribly much attention, and we should have, to Big Mike, who had this to say.
Now, let me tell y'all a little something. Kamala Harris is a dumbass hoe. Hillary killed Jeffrey Epstein. My husband, Barack Obama, is gayer than a motherfucker. And Donald J. Trump is gonna win this shit. Trump 2024, bitches. Let's go.
I mean, I don't know if that's real. I don't think so, but it could be.
I mean, I saw it with my own eyes.
Yeah.
What else was?
I mean, you're not gonna.
I saw the Yes Queen. You know,
the Yes Queen. The Yes Queen.
Did you see how the audience responded at the same time? It was obviously real.
Okay. Well, there it is. So that's your summary. If you needed to know what happened at the DNC.
Look, ultimately, Big Mike's the only Democrat I know with the balls to say something like that.
Yeah.
Because they just all sit in the fence and they wait for some directive. But Big Mike, credit.
Good for him. Why can no AI answer this question? And you can answer it first. How many R's in strawberry?
Three.
Correct, Simpiwe. Simpiwe is the smartest person in the show this morning. Three R's in strawberry, but why can't AI answer that question?
Which is interesting. A lot of people don't know the answer to that as well, but it has something to do with how AI reads the prompt,
okay,
right? Mm-hmm. And how AI is not actually reading like humans. So you know how the question is, how many R's are in strawberry? You'd look at the word and you'd count the letters. AI doesn't do that. So you'd have to prompt it to look at the letters individually, because the answer that AI would give is two R's in strawberry. And all of AI, not just like ChatGPT, but all the various AI softwares would answer and say
not so
two.
Smart after all. Yeah. Artificial dumb.
And they argue back and they're like, you're wrong. And people are like, no, it has three R's. And you basically have to prompt it to say, like, look at the word. Look at the letters individually and tell me how many R's are in the word strawberry.
That's amazing. So that we can basically, however bad things get, if, you know, Skynet happens and Terminator and Sarah Connor, I need to get you to the truck. I need to get you to safety. What is it? Get in the car. Something like that. Get on the bike. I don't know. Can't
get
remember.
In how,
get in the chopper. But that's a different movie. Are you Sarah Connor? Anyway, if that happens and the shit really hits the fan, all we have to do is ask the machines how many R's in strawberry and they'll
have a glitch and be like, three, two.
I like that. All right. So, that's good. I could get into that.
So you can be smarter than AI if somebody asks you how many R's are in strawberry.
All right. We still haven't figured out why the Facebook icon has changed on everyone's phones. And
has
it's not just me.
I don't know, Facebook on my phone.
Oh, yeah, good. Okay, good for you. Yeah,
there, you're not look, that old,
see? I'm not that old, change. No. Thanks I mean, for clarifying
it's
that.
It's amazing that this is even something I would have noticed. But driving into work this morning, I suddenly went, that looks out of place.
It does.
Right, it does. It's amazing how you get so used to the certain thing looking a certain way. When it changes, you instantly notice. But you could have things going on around you and not notice them for weeks.
Mm-hmm.
You know. Very bizarre. We still haven't figured that one out, by the way. This is an interesting question from Ben. Speaking of social media and apps and things, your WhatsApp self versus your social media self. What do you mean?
How different do you think that is? How different are you in WhatsApp groups as to how you are in social media when you talk about stuff?
Very, very different.
There we go. That's the answer that I was expecting.
Yeah.
Very, very different.
I think I'm pretty close. I'm not too different, because if I wouldn't say something, in social media, I probably definitely wouldn't say it in WhatsApp.
I can confirm that because I'm on WhatsApp groups with you, and of course I know what you like in social media, and it's a close. Terrific trait that you have.
It's close.
I think for a lot of people...
By the way, it's not because I'm supremely talented in any way. It's just because
it's
easier to just be you everywhere.
Yes.
So even if it gets you into trouble, at least you know who you are. I don't have to like tailor the message for this social media site and then for that one. I know people who do this, by the way, and they agonize over what to post on each of them, and nobody cares.
Yep.
Like nobody's that invested in you that they're going to go and compare your LinkedIn post to your Twitter, to your Facebook, to your TikTok, to your Snap. Nobody cares. Like most people don't give a shit about you. You think they do, but they don't. So just be you.
So the reason I want to bring this up is that I've got this friend in advertising called Dean. He's a particularly smart guy. He goes on agency, wins huge amounts of awards, does really cool, fun campaigns.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And he always has some very smart things to say about just realities around industry. Mm-hmm. And he brought up a point that I was thinking about weirdly this week. Is that when did beer ads become so damn serious? Why can't they just be silly again and reflect what guys are actually like? So when I said, like, what's your WhatsApp life like compared to your social media life? If we were to be honest as guys, what would be a good ad for beer ads? Something random, silly to laugh at. And let's be honest, good-looking woman.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's what we want.
Winner.
Very easy to please.
If you give a guy two or three beers, I can tell you they're not worrying about Kamala Harris. They're not worrying about global warming.
But we had a perfect example of how they've lost their way with this whole Dylan Mulvaney Budweiser thing, right? And listen, God bless you if you're trying to be an activist and you're in marketing or advertising, and good luck to you. I mean, you're facing an uphill battle because most people, like I said just a moment ago, don't care. But if you want to sell beer, just think about who the market is there.
And what,
these are men who like to drink. They like to drink because they want to get away from all the serious stuff. This is what Ben's saying. It's like, make it fun and people will love you for it.
I mean, you know the phrase, taking the edge off. You have a few beers because you want to take the edge off.
Right.
You have a few beers because you want to talk shit. Why do men drink beer? They don't drink beer because I've got something really serious to talk about right now. I want to have 4 to 5 beers. Or I'm like, it's beer is a lubrication for so many different things. It facilitates so many fun times. So why are beer ads about like friendship and unity and all this kind of cuck? It should be about silly shit, about like what happens when you have too many, or it's approaching the impossibly hot girl at the bar.
Isn't it because it's also corporatized and all these companies are trying to put the best version of themselves forward, like we do on social media and not on the WhatsApp groups? Like that's where there's a parallel that I can see here.
Yeah.
Like people are, and I have very little time for these people. The people who pretend to be something on social media and then in reality, they're something completely different. Because then you also, I said earlier, it's much easier to just be you on all of it. Mm. But it's also hard for you to have to keep reconciling who you're dealing with. Am I dealing with the Twitter you? Am I dealing with the Facebook you? Am I dealing with the WhatsApp you? I like the WhatsApp you. I don't like the other two.
Yeah.
The other two are like, just trying so hard to make other people like them.
Oh, the LinkedIn you with some people is the worst.
The LinkedIn you. Like someone's LinkedIn you has got to be the most insufferable version of that.
We need beer
Don't
ads.
You agree,
Oh, LinkedIn is amazing, guys, because everyone is prospering. Everyone is doing great. Everyone's gotten a promotion.
Yeah.
Everyone has insights on this ad. And oh my gosh.
People can argue it's the only positive social media, but I will argue it's a very insincere social media. So we need beer ads to be like WhatsApp groups and not to be like focus groups. And I think Bud Light, because they know that they're fucked up, they gave the UFC a whole bunch of money to remasculize themselves. And now in their latest ad, they've got Shane Gillis. Because if we were, again, really honest
Who's
about
Shane
beer,
Gillis?
One of Joe Rogan's friends.
Okay.
And Joe Rogan's got this wave of people that are about 7 out of 10 funny. Shane Gillis is actually really funny.
Okay.
So he became like the Bud Light spokesperson.
Okay.
Purely because when they do their protect
they brought
our parks,
for damage control.
Yeah, they did. And to save face. And if we are honest again, goofy-ish white guys make good beer ads. Because those are the guys that
but I think
throw it out
across
there.
The board, like what you need is guys driving a tank, shooting stuff, eating meat, laughing,
the realities
doing
of
stupid
what
shit. Yeah, like that's what happens. Like in my mind, that marries.
If you're not making someone laugh in a beer ad, I don't think you're doing it.
Okay. There's some instructions for the advertising
industry.
Well,
look, I mean, at the same time, because I will have my sports background come to the fore here, if you sponsor sporting events, you do cool things in sport, it's the same. Because, again, you're going into that guy realm of aspiration. Like, I want to be involved with a sports person or event, or you're making these people laugh.
How do you make the perfect ad for women? Simpiwe, any ideas? I mean, no pressure. We're just dropping this on you.
Shirtless men?
I guess. I don't.
Okay. I mean, No.
I wouldn't say shirtless men. I think you need to alter the approach completely different. I drink with my girlfriends. I like having a good time with my friends. Like, come on over. Let's pop a bottle of wine. Let's talk about whatever's happened this week. And like, cling, cling. Let's like celebrate or cry over the fact that we've either, you know, done something with our last. Yeah. So that for me would be like what I want to see. That's the reality.
I mean, it is. It's a well-known and established fact that men are much more visually stimulated. Women are much more stimulated by the story, yes. Generally. I mean, there are obviously exceptions to that because we're going to get someone who goes, I'm not like that in the comments just now. But I think that there are, like, story is massively important and connection is massively important for women, and feeling is more important. With guys, it's like funny, kind of jocular and visual.
Which is fine. Which is it's totally fine. I think the issue is that
it depends what you're selling. Like, if you're selling something that you want girls to buy, you market it differently. You're using that Stanley Cup, which you told us the story of.
Yes.
As soon as they started marketing it to women, it became a runaway success. When they were marketing it to guys who go camping, there were only like 15 guys in the whole world who went camping and cared about a Stanley Cup.
Yeah,
that.
And they like didn't really care about whatever has happened. Huh. And now they've branched out to accessories and they've done like a whole other multi-million business of like just selling accessories. But I think with advertising and what I've seen on TikTok that works as well is that people need to be able to just like take the piss. There's like a video that or trend that was taking place a couple of weeks ago where people would be like, this is the person that you thought you got. And then like they'd have a couple of drinks later and then it'll be like, this is the actual person that you got.
But that goes back to Ben's point about the WhatsApp groups. It's like you're probably, the real you is probably close to your WhatsApp.
Absolutely. Yes.
Right. And the fakest version of you is probably your LinkedIn.
But this is why social media is fake. Fun fact as well, Gen Z's actually love LinkedIn and they wish that more social media networks were like LinkedIn. Yes. They find it safe. They think there's a bit of a community where I look at it and I'm like, everyone's just
boring.
They're boring because everyone comes across as an expert. You know, everyone's a marketing expert. Everyone is a CI expert or they'll tell you about tax. Like, everyone knows everything. So you're just like, whatever. Whereas the other social media platforms where people are goofy and themselves, I'm like, oh, cool, this is cool. And then Gen Z's like, I want that. That looks
real.
Yeah,
but you said the word safe just now. Like, ugh. I can't remember who said it, but I listened to a podcast a while ago where a guy was talking about how this obsession with safety is precisely where we've become boring.
Yep.
Because everything that we've made safe, we've just drained the fun out of. Like, everything that is safe, this like putting people and relationships and everything into cotton wool, and it doesn't move and it just gets fat and dies.
That's exactly it.
And you don't want safety. You actually, if you're an adventurous soul, you want to get out there into the world. You don't want to be safe. Safety is exactly the opposite of what someone who's seeking to do something in their life should be after. The moment you feel safe, you should ask yourself, am I comfortable and do I want to stay here forever? And if that's all I want to achieve, have I lost ambition?
It's a good thing. I mean, you want to be safe when a cyclone hits your yacht in the Mediterranean. For the next hour or two, safety is a big thing.
Yeah.
No, if you're aquaplaning across the highway in your car, you want a bit of safety. But ultimately, it does nothing else.
Yeah, I agree.
Safety first. Whoever said that, smack that old trout in the mouth.
Cook O says, the real question is, who watches ads anymore? How often have you thought something because of an ad? Well, I mean, listen, there are brilliant ads that do pierce through the noise, right?
Yes.
And I think advertising comes under extreme criticism because it's, you've got to do so much in 30 seconds or a minute. And you've got to do so much in that 5 seconds that someone drives past a billboard, or the 20 seconds you listen to a show like this, or whatever. You've got limited time, and you've got to make everything potent and powerful and, you know, like grab everyone's attention. That's difficult. But when they get it right, they being the people in that business, man, it's good. Yes. When they get it wrong, obviously we criticize them horrifically. I mean, you know, if the guy who's painting your roof misses a spot, you don't go, oh, you're useless. You should never work in this industry again. You're like, can you maybe get that patch there?
Yeah.
But there's some industries that we're extremely critical, sometimes for the right reasons. You know, your doctor cuts your carotid artery by mistake. Yeah. Ooh. That's a problem.
A big problem.
That's a big problem. But otherwise, we should maybe just apply a consistent set of standards.
Maybe just have fun. I mean, because I'm a fan of economics and the ecosystem of life. Without brands and ads and stuff, you wouldn't have shows. You wouldn't have creators.
Would
you wouldn't
boring.
Have people would be boring. So it's all part of the mix. So I always respect that. But we can have more fun though.
Well, I see a nice compliment for people who've worked with us before. Both of these people, one of them still works with us. Auto Trader, Mapelo says, makes great ads. Naked Insurance too. I've seen the Naked Insurance ads. They are very clever. And well done to Ernest and the team at Naked. You guys are really, your advertising guys too.
And ultimately, people need insurance. People's lives need insurance. Yes. So cool. Yeah. If you're going to attract people to your company with something that the society needs, even better.
But I think make it fun is, if there's any takeaway from this, don't leave the show today going, we've got to take meth. You know, if you stopped listening at a certain point, don't do that.
Maybe.
Leave the show today going, let's keep things fun. We want more fun. Let's laugh more. Let's have more fun. And because you can choose that, it's really all in your hands. Like, it's nobody else's job to make you laugh. You've got to decide, I'm going to have a happy day. And you'll find reasons to laugh. Or you can wake up in the morning and go, I'm going to be miserable, like Greta Thunberg.
Yes.
And then you'll have a miserable day.
Horribly unfun female that. But also, and if the fun offends you, pull yourself together.
There
Just
we go.
Pull yourself
the
together.
The advice from Sam Neill's mom. Pull yourself together. That's the greatest advice we could possibly have. All right, Ben, well, thank you. We will catch up with Ben in another week's time and enjoy the rugby. You're going to Ellis Park?
I am. I'm so excited about that. Going to Ellis Park.
Good.
Yeah.
You don't have to worry about like the zombies afterwards.
No. It goes back to being hard to kill, but also I'm with really good people. you know, the big Tour of S team, we're going to do it right because that's how you do things. Be sure to obviously listen to the On the Bounce podcast, yesterday's show with Sandile.
Yes.
It was probably my favorite show of the show so far.
Ooh.
Of the 12 episodes.
And apparently the numbers for live viewing are going up and up and up. So if you aren't watching it live yet, you may be missing a thing. Because you can join in the comments, you see. That's what makes that nice. And you can actually be a part of the conversation like we do on this show. Or if you can't, then we'll watch it whenever it suits you.
Yes, and we give stuff away.
No pressure.
And Sandile's he lost a bet. So tomorrow morning before he flies to Durban at 7 a.m., he's going to be in the cold plunge.
Ooh.
Man United ruined everyone's weekend last week, so he's doing 8 degrees for a minute and a half.
Yes.
Oh, just before you run away, apparently you've got an update on the Please Call Me guy from Vodacom.
Well, it's now going to the Supreme Court again.
Yes. I thought this guy'd won. I mean, I thought
he kind
everybody
of did.
And we're all on his side, right?
Yes.
So, okay, we try to give us in 2 minutes. The guy worked there as a Vodacom employee in the late 90s into early 2000s, he went to his boss and said, what about this? And the guy's like, great idea. And then he said, okay, cool. What about some compensation? He's like, cool. We'll sort you out, whatever.
Yeah.
And then they basically made the thing and then they made all this money. To fast forward to where it is now, yes, he has won.
Yeah.
But then Vodacom are arguing that his financial formula is a bit wrong from his people. Mm-hmm. He originally went there and said, I want however much. Vodacom said, oh, we'll give you 10 million. To which he then said, not a chance. I think, again, I'm under correction here. Vodacom's biggest take this money and shut up was 47 million rand.
Right.
To which he still said, you are insulting and embarrassing me.
Yeah.
But then as the case got bigger, the legal team and advice became bigger. But ultimately, it's going back to the Supreme Court because Vodacom feel that the formulas are all wrong. So it's still in the mix.
This poor man. Can you imagine? You know, he's really was his idea, indisputably. Was his idea, right?
Deserves the money, but at what cost? This has been going on for like essentially almost 20 years.
But this is interesting because are they also including, like, in him calculating how much the idea is worth, also the legal fees? Because it's been about 10 years now, I think, that this is happening. So he's also not just saying that, yeah, I don't want 47 million because I don't think it's a lot. He's also like, I have to pay because I don't think those lawyers
will suck up that 47 million.
Those lawyers have looked at this as a business opportunity.
Yeah, sure. So I think that's also part of the, I think the issue and the back and forth is that he's actually like, I actually need to walk away with something.
Yeah.
And
they're probably on a contingency, which means that whatever he wins, get a percentage of.
But I mean, there's a couple of other steps here in that some people are saying that it's your prerogative to bring ideas to the person that employs you.
Sure.
So they feel like he shouldn't be compensated. He was just working there at a time and it was a really good idea. Well done. We'll take you out to lunch. And then the person who said to him, we'll reward you, people are now arguing that this guy does not have the rights to promise him anything.
Oh boy.
So if you want to get into this and, you know, get down to like the muck of it, it could go on forever and ever. And
what do you reckon the best advice is? Keep your good ideas to yourself.
No, I think keep your good ideas and package them and say, right, I've got an idea in place first.
Yeah.
I've got an idea for a profit share, which I think is going to be so amazing for your company.
All right.
It's an interesting thing because he was young and impressionable, trying to make a name for himself. He obviously wants to share good ideas.
Yeah.
And I think it's about sitting people down and being hard about things. But yeah. I would love to know, looking back at this now, if he got the opportunity to take that 47 million without all the lawyer stuff all that time ago, would he have done it?
He might
have. I think so.
Or is he just
ultimately happy
to slog it out for the billions?
All right. I want to let Ben go. We kept him way over his usual sell-by date. He's going to turn into a pumpkin and like disappear.
Cheers, keep him longer.
Thank you, Ben. Okay. So let's talk to Craig. I promised you that we would talk to this man. He is an OG of the South African music industry. And I'm thrilled that he's able to join us now. Craig Hines, of course, from the brilliant band Watershed. How are you, dude?
How are you, Garrett? Very good, and you?
I'm great. I haven't seen you in such a long time. You look good. What can I say? Look at you. I thought I'd be talking to some old man, but you look fantastic.
No, life is good. Moved down to Cape Town a couple of years ago, and I think the lifestyle here is just really chilled. So, yeah, so feeling good. Lots of music going on and cool stuff. Yeah.
So
and you too.
No, thanks. Listen, I'm feeling pretty good. I went for my my Discovery Health assessment on Monday.
No.
Well, it was my birthday. I had to do something, and I was prepared for, you know, like you're old now. So I'm 47. They came back and told me I've got a very good vitality, age of 41. I'll take it. Fuck yeah! Whoa. Right? I'm thrilled with that. I'm telling everybody, even if they don't want to know. I'm sharing that with people, like random people.
I'm young for
random
my
people on the
age.
Streets. I'm going, you, do you know that I have the vitality age of 41? Okay, so let's just quickly give people a recap here, because you actually have an incredible CV and you've been a part of creating songs that have become a part of South Africa, right? And it's left a lasting impression. For 15 years, this man has excelled in crafting unforgettable pop melodies, lead vocalist and the songwriter for Watershed. He propelled the band to legendary status as the country's premier acoustic rock group, and his repertoire includes timeless pop tunes and radio favorites from the past 15 years. You're a monster. You're an absolute juggernaut.
Gareth, I'm going to add a little bit more to that. We're actually on 25 years.
God damn, well done.
You got to add it too to the
well done.
That first.
Why did they tell me 15?
You know, we started in 2000.
Listen, you know, the music industry's changed so much over 25 years. You have to be able to do a whole lot of new things. You have to be able to do things differently. You have to think about events differently. You have to think about merchandise. When you started, it was like you could actually sell albums and make a living. Like, that's all you... By the way, what's that furry thing?
Like, what the... It looks so inappropriate.
Are those your ball hairs? What's going on? Oh, it's a dog. Thank God. Oh, wow. What is that dog's name?
This is Duffy.
Hello, Duffy.
Sure.
Sweet, man. Now, we just saw the fur, and
I thought, what the hell?
You got a very hairy something going on there.
A man. Yeah, a mane.
All right, so as I was saying, the music industry's changed a lot. You used to be able to just sell albums and that would be a living. I mean, like, you know, There was a lot of money to be made. Now it's a lot tougher in the music business. But in some ways, there are also opportunities. Just tell us about this thing that you're doing, Serenading the Untamed. I like the sound of this.
Yeah, you know, I think just to go back on your first thing there, Gareth, I mean, it's changed in incredibly, as you say. You know, back in the day, I've just got to get this Untamed one in order here, ready for her walk. You know, you're talking about the old days of CDs in the 2000s, and that was really, you know, when the music industry globally was just sort of just incredible. There was a lot of money to be made. You know, we were lucky enough to have grabbed a lot of that audience back then when it was still sort of a real physical audience. You know, people physically came through two shows. You sold physical CDs. You could put money to a unit sold. You know, and you could work out what you were going to make if you sold a platinum record. Mm-hmm. I mean, things change and for good reason. But unfortunately, a lot of that income has disappeared. And because of that, bands, you'll find, are touring again. Bands have to tour and tour and tour. You know, you've got to try sort of make up that income that you used to make with selling records, because you're definitely not getting too much from your Spotify's, etc.
No, they basically, they pay you like a percentage of a cent for every person who downloads. I mean, it's kind of ridiculous.
No, absolutely. I mean, it's really hard to understand, you know, and you sort of never get real answers from record labels, and you know, can't tell you where it's coming from. But anyway, we move on, and I think for the upside of streaming is that you are sort of, you know, you are a global release. You know, it used to be amazing when you were with a local label. And you've got an international release. You know, that was something to talk about. Anyone is global now. You can record a song in your bedroom and release it, and anyone in the world can hear it. Sure. And because of that reason, you know, songs are getting picked up globally. Bands are now touring more because they need the money. So your audience has grown. Sort of your superficial audience has grown. But I suppose at the end of the day, it is still, you know, boils down to getting people into a room. You know, you need to get people into a room. You got to think creatively. You got to, you know, you got to think out the box. And I think this is exactly what the Kruger show is all about.
Okay, so this is the point, right? Is you have to be creative, and you have been here, and you're combining a bunch of things that I think people love. So as I understand it, this is Serenading the Untamed. You're giving people the bush and that whole feeling, which is a uniquely South African thing. People come from all over the world to be a part of that. And you're giving them some music and all the other stuff that's tied into that. Like, you know, the fact that you've got that romantic feel, you've got the animals, you've got all of this stuff. It combines to make a pretty cool thing. Now, you're doing that now. It's now in September, right?
Yeah, 13 September, we up at Chokwane Camp. It's going to be, I think it's going to be incredible, you know, to be in the wild. I mean, I can't imagine how awesome it's going to be with the piano there, and, you know, it's just singing songs in this perfect setting. So it's, you know, for any band, it's the type of thing we get so used to playing in clubs and you know, concert venues, and you know, I think the closest we get to this sort of event would be a wine farm here in Stellenbosch or Franschhoek. You know, so to actually get into Kruger, which is the heart of South Africa, you know, to do this sort of thing, to play your music in that surrounding is quite
that's cool. Amazing. I've heard about this Chokwane camp. It's so funny that you're doing that there, because my dad was telling me the other day, he wants to book it. They put it up and then they take it down, right? So it's only there for a couple of months and then it moves.
Yes. Yeah, it's a sustainable, you know, it's everything's on solar, and they set it up in the winter and then it, you know, they take it away, which is cool because the earth then sort of gets itself together again.
Yeah.
And so I just love the idea of it. I think they have these beautiful glamping. It's a tented camp.
Well, I mean, I can imagine, you know, you kind of singing under the stars. This is a very cool like vibe. I think this is sexy as hell. So the animals are not your audience. There are going to be people in the audience. The animals might come, They might, you don't know. You could have a lion a couple of feet behind you. You got to watch out.
They will be there for Indigo Girl, trust me.
What a song. What a song. All right, so is this thing sold out already? I mean, are there still some tickets?
I'm pretty sure it's close to sold out. We've been chatting about it for a couple of weeks. But if there is something, it's definitely worthwhile getting on there now. I think the whole package just is. I think it's two nights. We're playing on the first night. And then it includes game drives. I say, these incredible, and that's open vehicle stuff. So it's proper. So
idea?
I cannot wait. No, it wasn't my idea. I wish it was. It's the same as so many of these great songs in the world. You wish they were your ideas and your things. But I just think it's fantastic and can't wait. Our team is super excited to get out there.
Indigo Girl, which you mentioned just now, I mean, that's also such a great song. When you have written a song like that, I may even have asked you this before, but I'm fascinated by this process. When you've written a song like that, and you play it for the first time and you hear it, not like final mix or production or anything, but just the melody, do you know you've got a winner straight away?
Yeah, that is a really interesting question. And I'll tell you why. Because some songs, and Indigo Girl particularly, was a song that I never thought it would be anything. For me, it was, I wanted to be in a rock band. I wanted the music to be loud and out there. And one day I wrote Indigo Girl. I remember writing the piano hook first. And then I needed to put a melody to it. And I started repeating the words Indigo Girl.
Yeah.
And this was also before Indigo Children came around it, because that's the number one question is the song about Indigo Children?
Yeah.
And I've never heard of that. So the word Indigo Girl started sort of swimming around in my head, and it worked, and it turned out to be the sort of ultimate person, the perfect person you could be with. And but for me back then, it was just going to be an album track, and even I put it on the In the Meantime album as track 9 or something. It was way down the list. You know, the early songs were Shine On Me and all of those.
Yeah.
So long story short, the album came out, and we didn't release Indigo Girls. So the first song was Shine On Me. Then we released Angel. Then we released In the Meantime. And then we released Yesterday Again. And it got picked up by a DJ and went onto radio without us even knowing. And suddenly the song shot the lights up in SA.
Those the same thing happened. DJs.
Yep. Now we've got to thank you guys, I tell you. Then the same thing happened in Europe. So a DJ happened to be on holiday in Cape Town when Indigo Girl was shooting the lights out here. Took the song over there and put it on a huge station in Europe, and it went to number one there as well. And because the station was so big, it shot around pretty much all of Europe. And for me, it was still today. I had one friend who said to me, Craig, that is your hit. And I was like, there's no chance that's going to be the song.
I repeat this so often that I think the audience is probably sick of it, but if I could have one talent, it's the ability to write one great song. And you've written more than one great song, but that one, you know, you didn't know. You had no idea, is what you're telling me. It's like you thought, nah, it's okay, we'll put it in. You said track number 9 on the album. It's like an afterthought. And look at that.
Yes.
It just blew everybody away. It's amazing. That's such a great thing to be able to do. Damn you, man. Damn you. I'm jealous.
It was sort of like a B-side, you know. I think we were lucky though, because we felt a lot of pressure after that song, with it being such a big song. And in 2005, then we released a record called Mosaic, and we had a song in there called Letters. And Letters in South Africa did the same work that Indigo Girl did. Actually, it was a huge song for us. And that for us made the whole band make sense, the whole music thing, because it was always the sort of, I mean, we've got stuff from overseas, you know, talking about Watershed as a one hit wonder band. Letters sort of came in and made it a career, I think, you know, and we now 25 years, Watershed is, next year is a big year for us. We're 25 years old. So, So it's
Are you going to do a big concert? Are you going to do a big party?
Absolutely. We're planning a huge year. We will do a new record as well, which I think will be our 10th album. We're planning a couple of big outdoors and then a couple of more acoustic indoor shows. We're going to dock it. Yep.
What are your favorite places to play? I mean, you talk about outdoors and you're doing this one in the game reserve on a riverbed at night. I mean, that's very special. But are there places that you just love playing, or does it depend on the crowd? Like, it doesn't matter where you are as long as the people are cool.
Yeah, I think people do make it, you know, and people also ask, you know, how can you play a song like Indigo Girl or Letters? I mean, I've played that song 10,000 times. and it's how can you keep playing that song? It's not actually about the song. It's actually about the audience. You know, every time it's about that feedback you're going to get from them and that buzz you're going to get from the audience, which makes you want to play it. You actually can't wait to play that song again because you know what's going to happen and you can't wait for that buzz, you know? So it is the audience. The audience makes it. But you get your classic venues, Kirstenbosch, in Cape Town. We played some beautiful venues overseas as well.
It's so great that you do love playing the songs that people want to hear. Because I heard a story, I think it was even from Billy Joel in an interview, where he said like he just doesn't want to play Piano Man or Uptown Girl. He can't do She's Always a Woman. He's sick of those songs because he's heard them so many times. And I'm like, oh, but dude, we love them. You can't stop. So never lose that. I hope you don't get jaded and miserable about your songs ever.
No, 100%. It's not about us. It's not about us. You know?
Look at this. Deirdre's comment. She says, oh, my word. I remember asking this man to marry me at one of their concerts many, many years ago. He took it well and bought me a beer instead. Look at that.
Yo.
Sorry, I interrupted you. Deirdre,
where was that concert?
Deirdre, you'll have to tell us. Do you remember? Yeah. I mean, you must have had a lot of women ask to marry you.
But I handle it well. I buy them a beer.
That's what I've been doing wrong. Okay, I got you.
Yeah, I know. It's one thing I do love about Billy Joel, you know, talking about him, is that I've heard that he keeps the first five rows of every concert open. Yeah. So, you know, normally the artists make those super high price tickets, and he keeps those for the cheap seats are the best seats.
Yeah.
So everyone with a buck has got to sit at the back, and he leaves that open till the end, and then he fills that up which I really think it's cool.
I know something else about him, which I think is very cool. He actually lectures music at Albany University, and you could go there for if you're studying music, you could go there for your normal lecture, and instead of, you know, the professor who's there to teach you about piano, you could end up with Billy Joel one day. I mean, wouldn't that be amazing? And have you ever seen that concert he did at Madison Square Garden with Elton John, where they played each other's songs together on two pianos?
I would probably say that would be, I mean, I think if you think back to that era, Elton John and Billy Joel, like, who wrote more hits?
Oh my God.
You know, it was just incredible. That must be an insane show to be at.
You've got to go into YouTube just because, thank God for the internet, right? Simpiwe, you'll love this too. You can go and find the Madison Square Garden concert where they're doing Goodbye Yellow Brick Road.
Mm-hmm.
And Billy starts it. Mm-hmm. And obviously they play the piano very differently and they've got such different voices. But it's just as fantastic when he's doing his parts as it is when Elton does his. And then they swap some other songs along the way in the show. It's just, I mean, like, to me, that would be a kind of heaven, right, Craig?
Jeez, tell me about it. That is just incredible. Yeah, I think that's, you know, I think that's also pushed, you know, going back to what you were saying earlier about CDs and streaming and live shows. I think there are a lot more collaborations that are happening.
Yeah,
I think artists are just trying to find their way, you know, trying to figure out this thing, because technology is changing things so quickly. It's just about the bands just like, okay, what's next? What's happening next? How are we going to move and change to make it real, make it happen? You know, so it's
I just want to throw this in too. Zwakele says, Shame, why does Simpiwe look so sad? Sprinkle some Amapiano into the mix.
I'm listening.
Dirk Kutsia says, Craig, I found the courage to approach a very hot girl who's now my wife when Indigo Girl played 16 years ago. It's still our song. Isn't that beautiful?
Yeah. No, it's incredible. I think that's something that you do have to keep going back to and, you know, remind yourself that, you know, musicians have to appreciate that songs are for people, you know, and how they get perceived and how people what people read into songs is also interesting, you know, and basically what you're doing. And I love the fact that Indigo Girl has been a sort of a soundtrack to many people's lives, you know.
Well, listen, you don't have to convince me that it's worthwhile catching up with someone like you. I wish you guys such luck on your 25 years in the music business. You've played a massive part in the South African music tapestry, which I just love. And good luck with Serenading the Untamed. Don't get eaten by anything, if you don't mind. Like, that would be nice.
I'll take Duffy along to look after.
Yes, and take the dog for a walk. I mean, she's desperate. Go. Get going.
No, she is. It's her time now. So.
All right. Amazing. Lovely to see you, dude.
Yeah, you too, Gareth. Yeah, thank you so much. Thanks for the chat.
Lovely. Nice to see you. There's Craig Hines, and they're doing a cool thing in the Kruger. Just gave us an excuse to talk to him.
Yeah.
I love musicians. I could talk to musicians all day.
I just like the fact that, like, they don't know the impact that they have with their music.
Well, saw those comments,
yes,
right?
Yes. Yeah. And it's like, oh, wait, what? Someone got married to my song, or someone was able to have the courage?
I see you just did a, like, I'll take the whole sofa move.
Oh, no.
Look at Simpia. She's like, oh, thank God. Now Ben's out of the way. I can have the whole chair to myself. Simpia is one of those people you invite her to your house, and she sits on the three-seater in the middle.
Yes.
And won't let you sit on either side.
Yeah, and this is where you're supposed to have all the snacks and you're just like, yeah, so you sit over there.
I like it.
And you get very comfy. Yeah. In fact, I need a blanket. And I'm really all right.
You know what? We'll get a next week Friday, we'll have a blanket for Simpiwe and we'll get her some snacks and drinks and we'll make a whole thing of it.
Thank you.
That is us for this week. Have an awesome Friday. Have a good spring day on Sunday. Have an excellent payday if today's that. And we will catch you on Monday, 6 a.m. Be ready. September's right here.
Yes.
Cheers. Bye, everybody. Ik wil naar een warm land, even op vakantie. Lekker bakken in de zon, daarop wil ik garantie.